Welcome, everyone, to the Undisclosed Addendum. Our sponsors for this week's addendum include Blue Apron, Sherry's Berries, and Zola Wedding Registry. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and you are listening to the podcast about all things undisclosed. In this latest episode of Undisclosed, Time and Distance, Susan and the team took issue with the Georgia Supreme Court's finding that the cell phone evidence in the Joy Watkins case placed him in the vicinity of the murder of Isaac Dawkins. By painstakingly going over every possible scenario that could occur in the space-time continuum that we understand ourselves to live in, the team may have proved otherwise. With us today are two of the hosts of Undisclosed. We have Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. Hello, Colin.
Hey, John. How's it going?
Really good. And I wanted to spend a moment and thank you for hosting the addendum last week. You have brought an air of professionalism to a show heretofore known for its amateurishness. So I do thank you for that.
Well, thanks for all you do. I think that you bring an interesting perspective, and I'm today getting over a cold, so please excuse my hoarseness as I talk.
Oh, no, it's great. You also sound a little bit nasal. It's wonderful. Also with us today is Susan Simpson. She's an associate at the Volkov Law Group and blogs at The View from LL2. Hey, Susan, how are you?
Hey.
Is your brain tired from having done last week's episode?
Actually, a little bit, yeah. It was a bit, this week was a little more hectic than usual.
Well, it was absolutely a virtuoso performance of cell phone analyzing. I've said this before, that doing a season of Undisclosed without Susan Simpson analyzing cell phone records is like going to a Superman movie where he doesn't fly. It's like you and cell phones are like, you know, watching a cheetah run at full speed. It's
I just wish there weren't so many cases that involve them.
Yes, it's true. It's true. You're doing what God intended you to be on this earth for. So thank you, Susan. Also with us today are Connie Walker and Monica Bell. Connie Walker is an award-winning investigative reporter for CBC National News in Canada and is currently the host of the acclaimed investigative podcast Missing and Murdered, Who Killed Alberta Williams? In December 2013, Walker launched CBC Indigenous, which has become a leading voice for coverage of Aboriginal issues at CBC News. Walker grew up in the Okanese First Nation in Saskatchewan. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
No, you did not.
I did not. See, I was hoping to seem like one of those cool people who just tosses off the names of First Nation tribes and just knows exactly how to pronounce them. But sadly, I am not that person.
It's Okanese.
Oh, Okanese. Okay. Oh, got it. So it's just like it's spelled.
Pretty much.
Okay, so that was a good job on the transliteration, Canadians. Thank you for your help. Also with us is Monica Bell. Monica Bell is a Clemenco Fellow and lecturer on law and a PhD candidate in sociology and social policy at Harvard. As a lawyer and a sociologist, she studies policing, police-community relations in the context of poverty, and the intersection of police regulation with race, family, housing, and social services provision. Thank you for being on the show, Monica.
Thanks so much for having me. I am absolutely thrilled to be part of this.
Oh, well, thank you. We're thrilled to have you. Now, I wanted to ask you, Connie, can you tell us a little bit about the Missing and Murdered podcast and how the case came to you?
Yeah, I'm really excited to be here as well and to be chatting with you guys about our podcast. It actually, you know, started with an email from a former RCMP officer who is now retired. And for those of you who aren't familiar, RCMP stands for Royal Canadian Mounted Police. So we got an email last October, and the subject said Alberta Williams murder. And I clicked it open, and it was just one sentence long. It said she was murdered by, and it named a person. And when I read the email, I didn't know who sent it at first. And I responded back right away asking to talk to him. And I was able to chat with him that very afternoon. And I was shocked when I found out that it was a former RCMP officer who had sent us the email. And the reason he sent it to us is because at CBC News, for the last couple of years, we've been investigating the cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada. And for your audience, you might not be familiar with this issue at all, but in Canada, Indigenous women face a disproportionate rates of violence. And there are estimates over 1,200 missing or murdered Indigenous women cases across the country. And some people actually believe that number is as high as 4,000. And so our podcast is looking into the kind of a deep dive into one of the cases, into the case of Alberta Williams, but also hoping to kind of shed light on the bigger issues that are at play.
Now, in investigating it, I have listened to about the first four episodes, and it's taken a very interesting turn. You've done something unusual for a journalist, which has brought your own perspective growing up Indigenous in Canada. And how has that affected your reporting on this story?
Yeah, it was a difficult decision to do that, because I think that typically when I'm reporting, like as an investigative reporter, and I'm doing more of a traditional story that would be on our national newscast or on a national radio program, you know, a journalist is kind of there to talk about and guide people through the story, but not offering any of their own perspectives or experience usually. And it's very much, I think, a different format when you're doing a podcast, because I really think it's amazing because you get a chance to provide this kind of context that you don't normally get to do in traditional media. And right from the very first episode, I wanted to be transparent about the fact that I'm Indigenous myself and I grew up in a reserve, and I'm very familiar with the issues that Indigenous women face in this country because I'm one of them. And so when we talk about disproportionate rates of violence and we talk about where this comes from, it's something that I have firsthand experience in. And I think that I was questioning whether or not to include that in the podcast because, you know, it's not typically a journalist's role to include their personal story. But I felt like it would help people understand the context a little bit better and what my understanding of the context is based on my unique experience. And it's something, I mean, I don't know what you guys think about including that or not, if that's something, it seems to kind of blur the lines a little bit, but it was something that I felt like it was important to do in this story in particular.
Connie, in terms of the podcast, you know, one of the things with the history and the context and the personal history is you go into the residential schools there in Canada, and could you explain a bit of that to the audience and also how you might see it relating to some of these issues you're dealing with in the podcast?
Sure. I think that, you know, there's a really long history of this troubled relationship between Indigenous people, and I'm sure in the United States, Native Americans and settlers who came to Canada and the United States. And it's similar in Canada, where obviously Indigenous people were here and then settlers came over. And there has been a really troubled relationship for 500 years in Canada. And I think that we're only starting now in, you know, the last few years to kind of explore that relationship, which sounds incredible because obviously it's been ongoing for so long. But I think that, you know, we're just starting to kind of scratch the surface of some of these issues like murdered and missing Indigenous women. And it's great that it's capturing attention and it's great that people care, and a national inquiry was called by the federal government to look into this issue. It's underway now. But I think that it's really important to try to paint the picture and show people where these issues come from. What is at the root of these issues? And residential schools is obviously a huge thing, and it was a huge thing in the United States as well, but in Canada. So for 100 years, the federal government funded these schools where Indigenous children were taken from their homes and taken from their parents and taken from their communities and placed in these boarding schools, essentially called residential schools, that were often run by churches. They were not allowed to leave. They were sometimes given a new name. They were not allowed to speak their Indigenous language or practice any of their culture. You know, the goal of these residential schools was to kind of kill the Indian in the child and to assimilate Indigenous people to better integrate into Canadian society. So you can imagine like a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old being taken away from their family and housed in these schools, and that happened for 100 years in Canada. And we know now that Indigenous people and children faced horrific abuse in these schools, that it wasn't only what some describe as cultural genocide in terms of stripping the culture away from communities and families, but also terrible physical abuse and horrifying sexual abuse. And those stories have only started to come to light really within, you know, the last 10 or 15 years. And because so many people started coming forward with these tales of abuse that they experienced during their time in residential schools, and they started filing class action lawsuits, that the government actually came together and settled these lawsuits and came up with this Indian residential school settlement. So gave each survivor of a residential school, you know, a lump sum payment of $10,000. And that if they experienced other abuse, then they would be forced to kind of recount very specific details of that abuse for more money, essentially. And I think that it's important to understand how residential schools and the impact of having that trauma and abuse affected the children who went, but also continues to affect their families and their communities in Canada, including my family and my experience. And we see those effects manifesting in this disproportionate rates of violence against Indigenous men and also Indigenous women, which is what our podcast deals with. But we also see it in every other aspect of Indigenous life in Canada. You know, we're more likely to be involved in the child welfare system. We're more likely to live in 76% of kids on reserve in the Prairie provinces live in poverty. You know, there are severe housing issues, water issues. And I think that there are probably similar issues with Native American communities in the United States, because there's a similar history. But I think that even in Canada, we're just starting to learn about this history. And sorry for going on and on and on.
No, it's incredibly illuminating. I was curious, what was the rationalization at the time that the schools were instituted? What was the rationalization for their existence? Were people saying, we need to help these impoverished Native peoples?
Yeah, it was. The goal was assimilation, basically, that they were seen as savages and that they needed to become civilized. And so we'll take their children and strip away their culture and who they are, and they'll better integrate into Canadian society. And I think it's important to be transparent about that was the goal, which, you know, obviously had a huge impact and toll on the families and communities, but that they failed, that there are many Indigenous nations in Canada that are thriving, and that the resilience of our communities and our families is the story of residential schools, really. That's the We did a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada, and the Justice Murray Sinclair, who was the head of that, at the end of it, he gave a final report, and he said that the story of residential schools is really about the resilience of children, and it's about the story of survival, and that this is something that needs to be understood in Canada, but it also needs to be understood that it's not only the social issues that we often hear about in the media, but we need to be actually representing and celebrating the successes and the fact that these residential schools failed in their attempt to assimilate Indigenous people.
And just out of curiosity, when were they instituted and when were they phased out?
Well, the last school didn't close until 1997.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. People think about it as something that happened, you know, decades and decades ago. And it was decades and decades ago. But the last one didn't close until 1997. And they were in operation for 100 years. And by the end, probably the last 20 years or so, it was mostly still funded through the federal government. But the churches didn't run them anymore. They were run by largely Native organizations. So that was a little bit different, but they were really in existence for a really long time.
And I had a question about, and I don't know how this plays into the Alberta Williams case in particular, but when you have a population that's under extreme duress from the government, how does that affect their faith in policing and in the government in general? Because one of the things that we've been discussing on the Joy Watkins case is he had basic faith in the system. The teenagers of Rome, despite their interactions with police, and perhaps Monica, you can comment on this, despite their interactions with police and his particular social group, they still had basic faith in the system. He felt he was innocent and that the system would prove that out. Do Indigenous peoples in Canada, I mean, obviously you don't speak for all Indigenous peoples, but is that a cultural phenomenon that do they buy into the system, or is there a different lack of faith?
It's complicated, but that's part of what we talk about in the podcast, is that there is this troubled relationship with police as well, because during residential schools, the police were often the ones that were forcibly removing children from their homes. And you hear all kinds of horrifying stories about children literally being ripped out of their parents' arms or trying to hide to get away from the police or the people from the school who came to take them away. And it was often the RCMP who was involved in that. So that was something that they were involved in, a very troubled relationship for a really long time. But also children ran away from the schools, obviously, right? Like it was horrifying abuse, and they ran away and they tried to get home. And there's, I'm not sure if you guys know the Tragically Hip, the Canadian band that.
Sure.
Yeah. So their lead singer is someone named Gord Downie, who was recently diagnosed with a brain tumor that he's going to die. It's not able to be treated. And in the last 6 months, he's dedicated this time in his life to raise awareness about residential schools, and in particular about the story of one boy who ran away from a residential school. His name was Channy Wenjack, and he ran away and he died alongside the railroad track. He was trying to walk the hundreds of kilometers to get home. And when children ran away from residential schools, it was often the RCMP who found them and brought them back to the school. So there is a distrust of police in Indigenous communities. I remember as a child growing up on our reserve, if the cops would drive by, we would jump in the ditch. We were like, oh, there's the cops. We got, and I have no idea why. Like, I don't know. Like, there wasn't any particular reason. It was just, that's what you did when you were playing outside. Was that a normal reaction? For us, I guess. Like, it's, so there's a very, very troubled relationship, not a lot of trust. And we try to explore that a lot in the podcast. And it manifests in, like, families of missing and murdered Indigenous women saying that their loved ones' cases weren't taken seriously by police. We talked to, you know, one mother who said she reported her daughter missing, and the police said, oh, she's probably out partying. She'll come back in a few days. And she said, no, I want to report her missing. And, you know, police not investigating cases very thoroughly or at all sometimes. And there have been even terrible allegations made against police about abusing, physically and sexually abusing, Indigenous women in Canada. And that's something that was just brought to light in the last few years. So it's a very troubled relationship.
Monica, I imagine this sounds very familiar to a lot of the areas that you've been researching.
Yes, it absolutely does. You know, it's interesting, throughout my listening to the Joy Watkins case, I have been really fascinated by the complexity of the class, race, geography, story, and a lot of what Connie was talking about in the context of Indigenous women in Canada certainly maps on to the African-American experience, which I've done a lot of research and writing on. But in the context of Joy Watkins, you know, it's in Georgia, and these are not, you know, people of color. And so this sort of trust in the system at the same time as facing, I mean, you had, you know, I think about Adam Cagle, one of the witnesses who moved to Thomasville, Georgia, in order to escape, you know, constant sort of harassment by the police. And the story just gets really complicated. But in the context of, you know, African-Americans, even specifically in Georgia, or W.E.B. Du Bois is writing in 1904 about this serious distrust between African-Americans and the police, and not even just the police, but the entire system, believing it wouldn't work, believing there was no recourse in it for the issues they were dealing with, but also that the system was really structured to reinforce racial hierarchy. So one of the consistent questions that I've been having as I've, you know, been listening to the podcast throughout the season is just, you know, how to think about how race and class and geography operate in understanding these problems of policing that are really cross-cutting across, you know, they're crossing national borders, they're certainly crossing racial borders and class borders. So that's what I've been thinking about.
Yeah, one thing that struck me about Connie's podcast was the sound of resignation in the voices of all the relatives of Alberta Williams, in their resignation that her murder would never be adequately solved. It was really heartbreaking to listen to.
It is heartbreaking. And I think that, like, you can understand that because it's been 27 years. And, you know, police are always limited about what they can say to a family or to the media or to anyone about an open investigation. But, you know, we talked to her brother and he was like, it's nice to listen to the podcast because at least you get a sense of what's happening. He said, you know, we haven't heard from the RCMP in years. He's like, 5-8 years ago, like, there was nothing, not even a blip from them about anything involving Alberta's case. But also just in terms of the media coverage, like, it's been, her disappearance wasn't reported on at the time, except to say, you know, there was an ad in the classified section that said missing woman, you know, Alberta Williams last seen. And there was maybe a short article when her body was found, but that was kind of the extent of the coverage. And I think that for a lot of families, they have felt ignored by not just the police, but also the media, and that there has been this indifference from society as a whole about what's happened to their loved ones. And I think that just listening to you talk about your research, and I see so many parallels between the Indigenous experience in Canada and the African American experience in the States. And I think that that's something that is really important to discuss and important to make those connections.
That's one marked difference with the way that things have played out in, well, in Georgia and in Joey's case, is that the issue of the victim being ignored is not something that is experienced in these cases.
Yeah, it's the total opposite situation. You have a situation where the police very aggressively and perhaps too aggressively pursued their particular agenda in this particular case. I mean, it's, you know, total opposite.
Christmas is right around the corner, folks. We're talking about just a few days. But don't panic. Even those of you who have not finished your shopping, I've got the perfect gift idea for you. Because no matter who you're shopping for, Sherry's Berries is the one-stop shop for everybody on your list. I had these berries a couple of weeks ago. They are amazing. Chocolatey, decadent, juicy, sweet. Shareable, although you're not going to want to share. And you don't have to battle the crowds to get the perfect gift now at the very last minute, because you can shop with convenience right from your home. And Sherry's Berries has more than just berries. They've added amazing new seasonal treats just in time for the holidays. You get to choose your delivery day, and Sherry's Berries will deliver your gift fresh and on time, guaranteed. Again, Christmas is right around the corner, and there's only one way to get this amazing $19.99 Sherry's Berries deal and help support our show. Just visit berries.com. That's berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner and type in US2. Sherry's Berries has something for everyone and every taste. Don't miss out on this great deal, and have a happy holiday season.
I was kind of struck by listening to a lot of the audio tape. At least on three occasions, there are times when officers from not just Floyd County, even a couple times Rome, they're talking to witnesses and they repeatedly emphasize how there's a mother crying every day. I just see her crying and now I got to solve this murder, which always struck me as a little bit odd. Like, of course the mother's sad. Why are you going around telling all these witnesses, oh, there's a mother crying? I guess it's like emotional, trying to, I don't know, get them on board with solving the case. But it was a very common theme throughout the investigation.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, thinking about that drawing upon the mother, the image of the mother as a humanizing factor. You know, it's really important that we do something about this incident because there's a mother crying. You know, I've done some research on African-American mothers in D.C., and one of their consistent complaints is that when they do call the police, you know, sometimes, depending on who it is, you know, of course, it's more complicated than a general story, but they often don't show those kinds of concerns. So basically their tears don't matter. And I think that's a way in which you see this distinction that you were talking about, where there's a kind of a hyper-aggressive focus on helping the victim or responding to the concerns of the victim's family here that drove a certain type of really aggressive policing and investigation.
That's actually something that attracted us to the Alberta Williams case, was that it actually runs counter to the narrative that we often see, which is that police are indifferent or maybe not as aggressive in their investigations of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Because the only reason that we're doing this story is because a former RCMP officer cared enough that after he retired, you know, almost 30 years mm-hmm. later, still thinking about this case, and he sent an email to the National Public Broadcaster, you know, out of frustration, saying that this is still unsolved and we always felt like we knew who did it. And I think that when you're talking about the Joey Watkins case and about how police, we do kind of explore some of that in our podcast as well, because the officer that came forward actually also shared his notebooks with us, his police notebooks about the investigation at the time. And that's something that is, you know, unprecedented in Canada, as far as we can tell. But so we actually got to see that there was an investigation going on, and, you know, who they talked to and when they talked to them and where their kind of investigation, how it unfolded. And it's similar in that, you know, they identified a suspect right away, and he's spoken to us about how and why that's happened. And when we've kind of gone back now 27 years later to talk to people, there are some things that they ruled out completely that we were able to find, you know, because the suspect in Alberta's case told police that he saw Alberta get into a truck at the end of the night with a mysterious white guy. And that was something that police never believed. They just never believed there was a white guy in a truck. They thought that that was just totally a made-up story. And in our investigation, we were able to find three people who said they saw, other than this suspect, who said they saw Alberta get into a truck at the end of the night and with two or three white guys. So I think that it's really frustrating in some ways because it's been 27 years and it's really hard to rely on people's memories of what happened, even when they were eyewitnesses and are sure they saw what they saw. But it's all the little disparities are really, you know, you wish you had cell phones or video surveillance that you could rely on. Although I guess I'm learning that cell phones are not as
well. No, they're accurate for some things. And, you know, what Susan has discovered is that in many respects, they make it nearly impossible for Joey Watkins to have been anywhere near the scene of the crime. So, you know, they do have certain use.
They are a data point that you can take in. It's
yes.
It's how it's getting used, the problem.
Yes. And remember, incoming calls are not useful for location information.
Only incoming calls. Then. That we know of.
Yes. But I was going to talk about, in terms of the RCMP, are they known for, and I'm sure this varies across the country, but are they known for particularly aggressive policing or for the opposite? I mean, your interview with the RCMP officer in question, he seems very diligent and but not aggressive. But of course, that's only what I heard from the podcast. Is that an issue across Canada?
You know, I mean, I guess I think the difference between these two cases, right, is that it seems like in Joey's case that police had a theory that they were just going to make work in some ways, right? Like, I think that the difference with Alberta's case is that they had a theory and they were like, we can't make it work, so it's just going to stay unsolved, right? Like, they couldn't. I asked him once, I was like, did you ever feel like you're so certain you know who did it? You're so certain that you have the right person? And he still, even after listening to the podcast and the other things that we've uncovered that they didn't investigate at the time, he still says he's certain. And I asked him, I said, did you ever feel like you were close to making an arrest? And he said, no, like, we just never had enough. You know, we really believed this. I wasn't the only one who believed it. We all felt really strongly. We spoke to one of his colleagues who sent us also some of his notes and talked about how they were pretty sure about what had happened, but they just never had enough to lay charges. So they never did. So I think that you're right in that it's not a uniform thing across the country. There are cases, I'm sure, that where the RCMP can be criticized for that. But in this particular case, they believed something quite strongly, but they never felt they had the evidence. And so it's still an unsolved murder 27 years later.
See, in America, we have two sort of competing impulses in terms of what we want from our police. We want a professional, diligent force, but we also want our freedom. But we also have an authoritarian impulse in the United States, sort of frontier justice thing. And that often comes into play in more rural areas because police have a little more there's less people around to check their authority. I think, Monica, this has been a big area of your study.
Well, it's an area I'm actually writing about right now. One of the proposals that some people throw around about reforming the police is consolidating very small police forces so that you at least have some sort of organizational check over people. Because part of the bigger issue that I think comes out in all of these cases, and that it sounds like may well be an issue in Canada as well, is police departmental culture. So, you know, it's not necessarily that the story isn't about individual police officers that kind of become unhinged. It is to some degree, but the bigger story is what kind of incentive structures are we creating? What kind of culture exists within departments? And when you have super small departments in which, you know, certain police officers can kind of have individual authority that maybe exceeds what we want, basically, that's an issue that comes up in part because they don't have other people there to check them and don't have the sort of institutional structure to surround and control that. So that's something that I've been thinking about a lot as well, and that people are proposing.
Well, in the Joey Watkins case, many of the teenagers in town talk with fear of Stanley Sutton, that he was a constant presence. And that seems atypical to urban settings. But I don't know, perhaps is that my own impression? Am I correct in that, Monica?
Well, you know, it's a little more complicated than that, right? So a lot of the research I've done with young people has been in Baltimore. So I've led a study, a youth participatory action research study in Baltimore in summer of 2015. And my team was talking to young people throughout the city about their police interactions. And we were hearing things that sounded like what the young people were saying about Stanley Sutton, but it wasn't just about him. It would be about certain units. You know, sometimes it would be about particular officers, but, you know, it was a random assortment of officers. It wasn't just, you know, one person. And I think this is just a size issue, but the kind of basic concern, this idea that police authority can, you know, really affect people's daily lives and cause that sort of fear of authority, that's really sounded very similar to me, even if it wasn't just about kind of one massive figure. The way I interpret Stanley Sutton is it's not about him. It is about him to some degree and his personality and the crickets and all of that. But at the end of the day, he is a product of a system that allowed him to use his authority in this particular way. And so I'm hoping that, you know, in all of these stories, we're remembering that there are structures that are allowing this to happen more so than just bad individual charismatic actors.
And I get the sense there's this weird tension almost between an expressed like dislike of the police, as they'll call them in Rome, and an overall trust that remains in the system, because they'll say like, oh, don't get involved with the police, stay away from that, don't trust the police, don't trust Stanley. But Joy's conviction, they trusted.
Mm-hmm. You mean they put weight behind it because it happened?
Yes. So even though they can express like concern or suspicion or a lack of trust in individual parts of the system, they still don't have a skepticism of the actual outcome of the final product, I guess.
And I think this is a real difference between what I saw among young people in Baltimore and what we see in the Watkins case. And I think, frankly, that's where I suspect the kind of structural racism issues and the historical issues really come to bear, because it takes a long time. I think it takes really generations to get to a point where you think this entire system, and where it almost just happens. Like one of the things you said earlier, Connie, that really stuck with me is, you know, this is just the way it was. We just got into the ditch. We didn't know why. We didn't know what we were fearing. Well, I would chalk that up to culture that's embedded over time. And I don't think what we have in the Floyd County situation is a space where people have that long-term generational mistrust of the system that would allow them to say, okay, well, this entire system doesn't work. But I think in the African-American context, and it sounds like maybe, you know, in the context of Indigenous folks in Canada, that you have a similar, you might have that sort of generational issue.
For sure. And that was one of the things that we asked the RCMP officer who came forward about, was just what was the relationship back in 1989 in Prince Rupert, British Columbia? Because Prince Rupert, if you're not familiar, is in northern British Columbia, and it's kind of a port city, but, you know, really high Indigenous population and then obviously the non-Indigenous. And he said for policing, it was kind of an us and them mentality. And that despite that, he maintains that, you know, Alberta's case was investigated thoroughly. But it was actually just last year that the head of the RCMP was at a meeting with Indigenous leaders in the capital of Canada, in Ottawa. And he admitted that there are racist police officers in his force. And he said, I know there are racists in my force. I don't want them here. And they've also admitted to not investigating these cases as well as they should have. I think that we're just getting to a point now where there's this transparency about some of those issues that, you know, these conversations weren't happening 5 or 10 years ago. And like trying to understand how that culture is changing is really interesting, and what's leading to the change. I think it has a lot to do with the coverage of these stories, and the shift to digital has kind of given space for diverse voices, including Indigenous voices in Canada, to be heard, and that there's a recognition now because of we're not relying on traditional forms of broadcasting and like the evening newscast, radio newscast and what white editors are deciding is important. Now we actually have metrics. You can find out how many people are downloading Undisclosed. You can find out how many people are interested in the Joey Watkins case. And same thing with the shift to digital. So I think that gives the space for voices that weren't given the opportunity before. And maybe that's kind of helping to lead these conversations that are happening.
And an interesting analog, you know, the leader of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, so the IACP here in the U.S., recently, just in October, apologized for racism against minorities in the U.S. So it's kind of a similar analog to what you were talking about. And yeah, absolutely, the democratization of voice about what's going on is an important factor there.
Frika for dinner this evening. Yeah, it's a lot of fun to say, but it's also delicious. Why did I have frika, you ask? Well, it's because Blue Apron's recipe for tonight's dinner was pork chops with frika salad. It was delicious. Almost as good as the blackened catfish with Veracruz sauce, but not nearly as good as the Blue Apron chicken cow soy with crispy wonton noodles that I'd cooked on Monday. You hear me tell you every week about Blue Apron, but now around the holidays, I think it's really important to emphasize the fact that for less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron will deliver a seasonal recipe along with pre-proportioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Now, I know some of you are listening to this surrounded by all sorts of greasy, nasty holiday food that you're worried about eating the next day as leftovers. Listen, with Blue Apron, you don't have to worry about any of that. You get exactly what you need and no more. What's better? It's healthy. It's made with fresh ingredients. It's sustainable. It's better than whatever is in front of you on that table right now. I'm talking to you, listener, staring eagerly at the gingerbread cookies. Don't. Just don't. So listeners, check it out. Go to blueapron.com and check out this week's menu. Sign up and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/up. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/up. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Well, also, of course, there are racists on police forces. There are racists everywhere. I think, you know, racism, and by the way, it sounds like a horrible term. You know, it's obviously freighted with a lot of negative weight, but human beings are tribal animals, you know, and racism comes up emotionally in people, you know, without even realizing it. And you can't outlaw a thought or an attitude. So you can say, yeah, that attitude is ugly, which it is, you know, but you can't outlaw it and you can't make it, you know, against the law for people who have those feelings to serve on police forces, you know.
But you have to be very careful about how it impacts their job.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to provide a check and a balance and make sure that it isn't affecting their job.
Another case that just was unfolded in the last few months in Canada, where a really well-known Inuit artist was found dead in a river in Ottawa. And police initially gave interviews saying that no foul play was suspected, almost like really, really quickly after her body was found. And then an Ottawa City police officer went online and made some racist comments about her disappearance and her death. And, you know, it was revealed that the person who was making the comments was a police officer, you know, working on the force that was supposedly investigating her death. And now, like, after this kind of came to light and he was put on suspension and his comments were investigated, you know, now they're saying that, oh, this is a suspicious death and they are investigating and asking people to come forward with information. So I think that you have to be really careful about, obviously, you know, acknowledging that there are these ideas out there, but it's so implicit in everything that you're doing. And especially as somebody who works in law enforcement or who's part of the judicial system, like, you have to be really, really careful about, you know, how that's going to impact their job and how that impacts their investigations.
I think this goes back to the point, though, that everyone has some sort of, you know, pathology along some sorts of lines. But what we have to focus on is creating structure so that these things don't matter. Because I don't want to get into the business of thinking, oh, well, you know, police officers and prosecutors, the real problem is that they are individually racist and that they're bad actors. And I don't think that's right. I mean, I think many people who go into policing have the best of intentions, go into it for public service, maybe because of some of the incentive structures we've created and because of resource issues, they, you know, develop tunnel vision and focus. You know, I think there are many different layers of this issue, and I want to be careful not to make it about kind of individually racist officers as opposed to about structures that create disparate outcomes, because sometimes those structures lead to what we see in the Joey Watkins case, which doesn't on its face look like racism, but is actually authoritarianism run amok in ways that we see play out in particularly negative ways for minorities in general. So, you know, it's really just that kind of correction to focus on the structural and cultural context a bit
yeah.
more.
Well, Monica, I wanted to ask you about, I mean, police are organizations, you know, they're big police organizations, they're small organizations. I wanted to ask you about the effect of organizations on police tunnel vision, because they are workplaces. They're workplaces like any workplace. And what do you think are the sociological causes that make police stick to a theory? And obviously there's, you know, entertainment, we play up, oh, he had a hunch, you know, he was a cop with a hunch and he stuck to it, you know. But what do you think are the things at play that may make police ignore, you know, important information?
I think there are so many that it's going to be a little difficult for me to get through all of them.
Okay, well,
but
this is the top.
But, you know, so I'll make some broad strokes. So one thing is, you noted, police departments or organizations, they're often local administrative agencies, and people work together and they develop small group culture. And then on top of that, kind of there's the ethos of what we think police are. So police are really the guardians of our public safety, and the people that we sort of deify in the policing world are people, as you noted, who have a hunch and they follow it and they always get that, you know, bad person. And because of all of that, and it comes out through the media, it comes out through the stories we all tell each other about, you know, policing from an early age, it comes out from police officers being in schools and all of this, that whole kind of cultural conception of police really affects individual officers. People who go into policing want to be that hero, and they see themselves in that light often, but then are confronted with the reality of the work that they do every day, which is it's really difficult to gather enough evidence. It's really difficult to get witnesses to talk to you. You know, it's just really very difficult work. And when you're confronted with the gap between your conception of what you're supposed to be doing and the reality of this confronting you, it's really hard not to try to make a case. And then when on top of that, to be a police officer is seen as a sort of art and, you know, being a certain type of person rather than, you know, a set of specific skills or, you know, ways of doing the job. So when it's, you know, the type of person who just has an idea and they follow it and they always get the right person, if that's the idea of what a police officer is supposed to be, it's difficult, I think, for many officers to avoid developing tunnel vision. So basically the very idea of going with your gut instinct, that equals tunnel vision. And so in that type of environment, it's easy to develop. And then on top of that, you're confronted with the pressures of the organization. So the pressures to move cases, the fact that many police departments lack resources. They really don't have a lot of, they don't have the same resources and time to investigate in the way that, you know, many people have been investigating through Undisclosed and through other podcasts, some of these serious cases. And so when you combine all of these issues, so, you know, the culture of policing in general, small group departmental culture, resource issues related to both money and time, and then sort of the individual psychology of policing, I think you have really a devil's brew that leads to tunnel vision many times. And I think it's actually surprising. I mean, I think there are many instances of tunnel vision that we have not yet uncovered. And it's perhaps even surprising that some officers are able to avoid it, given those constraints.
How successful are the ones who are aware? How successful do you think they actually are in being able to avoid it? Because that was one thing that came up in our investigation, is that Gary is quick to say, we never wanted to get tunnel vision, but we identified a suspect very early on and everything led back to him. We investigated other avenues, but, you know, so he's obviously very aware of that. But like, even if an officer is aware, like how successful are they to make sure that they're not falling into that rut?
I mean, part of the problem here is this, it's really hard to evaluate that, right? I mean, the way you would know is if you start off with a suspect and then change them a lot of times. But sometimes you do know the person early because of, and so it's really hard to know that. I think trying to develop an ethos really at the training level, but also reinforced consistently in departments that you should be second-guessing yourself constantly, and that we're not going to punish you for taking longer on a case because you're second-guessing yourself. Those kind of incentive structures need to be dismantled, I think, in order to really do something about tunnel vision.
And the bigger problem there for dismantling it is that the prosecutors don't want them second-guessing themselves, don't want them doing this kind of like maybe, maybe not dance, because that creates Brady material that they have to turn over.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
We at Undisclosed are really excited to welcome a new sponsor, the Zola Wedding Registry. You can take so much out of the stress and hassle of planning a wedding and getting registered for the gifts by using Zola, because it's a one-stop registry. Couples can register anything they want, from sheets to a wine subscription, honeymoon funds, because Zola works directly with more than 450 brands. So the happy couple can find everything they want in one single place, and so can their guests. Brands include KitchenAid, SoulCycle, Saunas, Ralph Lauren, and so, so much more. And here's the thing, it's so convenient. It's the highest rated registry app on the iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch to register on the go. So it's available everywhere. And you can love it or leave it. Couples can have gifts shipped now, later, exchange them for something they love. You can do group gifting. Multiple guests can contribute to bigger ticket gifts. They also do price matching, so your gifts are not going to cost your guests any more than they'd buy anywhere else. They also help with sending thanks, because couples can export their list of gifts and senders to make sending those thank you notes a snap. And guess what? Couples are going to receive 10% off the entire site for a year to complete their registry. So, Zola is the wedding registry that will do anything for love. All the gifts, experience, and funds you want in one single place. Listeners receive $50 when you register and use Zola. Visit zola.com/UP for details. That's zola.com/UP. ZOLA.com/UP.
Also, as a police officer and a prosecutor, you're living in this fog of data points. You're getting data points of varying degrees of reliability from all over the place, and you have to use some human instinct to pick through those. And if you're constantly questioning your human instinct, you're left with just a fog. And I don't know how you find clarity in that situation. I mean, interestingly, the RCMP officer who brought Alberta Williams' case to you obviously was very dogged. This stayed in his mind after all these years. That's something you want in a police officer. You know, we want so many of these qualities. You know, we want an inquisitive mind. We want somebody who latches onto a mystery and wants to find the perpetrator, who wants to do good. All these things are good, but they also contribute to a single-minded tunnel vision that can lead to the wrong person. In the Alberta Williams case, there's two very strong possibilities, but they're very divergent. You've got, you know, the Highway of Tears, which could well mean either serial killers or, you know, there could be several serial killers who have been preying on Indigenous women in Canada. Or you have an equally plausible scenario of a family member who got into a terrible situation and overreacted. You know, those are both.
There's a third possibility. You have to keep listening.
Oh, I got to keep listening. I'm only up to four. We got to the residential school part and my heart was breaking. And I had to stop. So it's really your fault, Connie.
No, it is. No, it's true. I mean, it's, I think that's what makes it really interesting. And for me, at least, as a journalist covering these stories, it's obviously like a compelling mystery, right? Like you get caught up in it. But I think providing the context was really the most important thing for me, because there are hundreds of families like Alberta's. And I'm sure with the Innocence Project, you see that there are so many people who deserve this amount of attention and this amount of investigation into their cases. And so it's really important to kind of look at those structural things and look at the bigger picture and see how we can identify what the issues are outside of the individual cases, which is, I guess, Monica, what your work is really all about.
So a big part of this week's episode of Undisclosed was that at some point the police and prosecutors must have realized that the cell tower evidence actually was clearing Joey of the crime, and yet they continued with the case. Now, it sounded like there's some disparity in when they claim to have found out that information and when they may well have gotten it. Is that correct, Susan?
Well, not so much claimed. It's just the only thing left in the file shows in September, so like very late in the game. It was AirTouch at the time of the crime, and then Verizon bought them, so it was Verizon by then. But Verizon sent over the locations with that cover sheet saying, here they are again. There is no indication other than that, you know, again, that would make you think that they had it before then, which is why I originally thought they just didn't even have a clue before, you know, they're ready to make an arrest, essentially. But from the GBI file, it's pretty clear, I mean, blatantly clear, that yeah, they did have the locations. Yeah, they did test them out. Yeah, they did check into it. Yeah, they even got a report on what towers were involved, if they were, quote, overlapping somehow. And yet they have done a very good job of removing every trace that would indicate that it happened, which to me suggests it has to be intentional, because the way those files work, and they're very, it's a bunch of notes, bunch of officers kind of interrelated, to not even leave a suggestion of a gap means it wasn't just like a paper taken out. It was someone went through and like purged that whole file, to me.
But I think that to fight the institutional inertia at that point, like let's say they did in fact have the realization that the cell tower evidence was making it very likely that the guy they were close to arresting was not the criminal in question. I've never been, a policeman or a prosecutor.
But that drive test was not that late. That drive test was a month after Sutton came on the case.
So you think they had that definitively? I mean, because again, this is what year? This is 2000 or 2001? Baltimore, for the first time, had used cell phone evidence in 1999, right there. I mean, this is still very, very new for police officers.
But they had it. They had the GBI file shows. They looked into it and they got the records, and then they lost all of them, which there's two parts. One, we know that they wouldn't have been favorable to their case because they can't be. And two, the fact that they lost everything. If it had been even ambiguous, they would have left it in there or had some way to spin it as an argument in their favor. But given the distances involved, it's pretty clear what they found was that Kingston Tower just can't be close to the murder scene because the mountains are in the way. So that's a hard fact. No matter how you want to like fudge the data or try and be like, oh, it's ambiguous. I mean, that's a pretty solid reality point right there that I think they must have struggled with and ultimately just decided to, you know, ignore. But what's interesting, too, on the point about like tunnel vision and abandoning it, there is a note from the Rome police file that was written right after we know now that test was done. Sorry, it's in the Floyd County file, but it's Sutton talking about wanting to go do some interviews. And then he says, I talked to Moser about it. Moser didn't see the point, which makes me wonder if Moser was no longer seeing the point in investigating because he saw the cell phone records and realized this was not going to happen.
Yeah, I just wonder, there's also, we're assuming that both organizations, Rome PD and Floyd County, had the exact same information, that their information coverage was perfect. You know, again, these are human beings involved and, you know, we don't know who had what information. So was it Moser who did the drive test?
No, it was Tommy Shiflett. The GBI file says that it's Sutton and Tommy Shiflett doing it. I don't know for a fact that Rome got it, but...
Got it. It seems like, and the picture of this has been coming out over the whole season of Undisclosed, that there was no dissuading Sutton from finding that Joey Watkins had committed this murder.
Sutton could have seen someone else do the murder, and he would still have thought Joey had done it.
Yes. One thing that I thought also was very valuable about Connie's podcast is that having the perspective of law enforcement, that they are willing to talk. And I really wish that Rome PD and Floyd County Sheriff's Department would speak with Undisclosed and, you know, they could clear up a lot of what exactly happened in the Joey Watkins case.
I do, too. And if there's any people out there from the Floyd Rome agencies who want to talk, we would love to hear from you.
That's not common, actually, at all in Canada. I mean, because we're doing these unsolved cases, it's actually very difficult to get police to say anything about them, because even though, you know, some of them are 27 years old or even longer, they're still considered open if they've never been solved. Like, they don't have this cold case distinction. So for an active RCMP officer to talk about any of it is really unlikely. And we do eventually get an interview with a current RCMP officer who speaks more about the bigger picture, but he told us that Alberta's case, since our podcast has started airing, they've received new information and that it's now considered very active, which is something. He wouldn't talk to us back in the summer before the podcast had started airing. But for Gary to speak out the way that he did and send a tip to CBC is unheard of. Like, I've never encountered that in an ongoing investigation in that way. So it doesn't often happen here either.
Well, Floyd County, if you're so confident in your case against Joey Watkins, that's closed, according to you guys. So, you know, feel free to talk to us about it.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
I'm trying here. Come
yeah,
on, Susan.
No, I try. They've made it very clear that, I mean, this is not just the police officers. This is like the DA has made it very clear she will not talk to me and does not want to meet with me. So that's not going to happen.
Now, I wanted to get to some social media questions because the cell phone episode obviously lit the internet on fire. But I had some really good ones. Here is from @GreenTheMachine, who says, as cell pings have been raised in habeas already and they clearly prove innocence, what can be done? And since the Georgia Supreme Court has accepted a fact that seems provably wrong, is there any recourse?
Not for the cell phone stuff. That's done and done. I mean, it's over.
Any aspect of the cell phone stuff?
Not in relation to the actual science and what it shows. Like, the fact that Joey is provably innocent is meaningless.
Wow. Okay. If Joey gets a new trial, can they use this week's summary of cell recordings in closing arguments? The jury would get it.
They could, but I don't see them taking this to retrial. It's another situation where their case is gone. They have no case. They only got it through the last time because of, well, a combination of unfortunate factors for Joey, but this is not a case you could bring again.
I got another one. This from Meredith Bliss, who asks, did Heath have a cell phone? If so, were records pulled for his trial? Any chance those might place Wilson at Isaac's rec?
No cell phone there. So nothing to go on for that. I do wish I'd gotten records for Joey Rhodes' cell phone, but they didn't. An interesting fact is that apparently, so Wayne Benson, the eyewitness, says that at some point, Officer Reeves, one of the officers kind of tangentially involved in the case, came to his house and asked for his cell phone number. And he didn't know why and didn't know what it was for, which to me only makes sense if they wanted to pull his cell phone records to find out perhaps even more about what time exactly he called. But that didn't happen.
Well, it either didn't happen or it disappeared from the files.
Yeah. Or if it did happen. Yeah.
Here's another one. This from Eddie, who is at WizEd, who says, were there any speed traps or traffic cams on any of the highways that may have caught something that night?
Not that I've ever seen suggested. I don't think that was something they had in place in Rome.
Yes, we got another one. This from Chef Johnny F., who says, what if any CCTV exists in both cases? Lots of places mentioned, i.e. the Texaco garage. They're asking if there's the Coke plant. You know, they might have had security cameras. Is there any existent security footage?
No, and I think that could have been a very viable route for them to take back then. And I wish someone had thought to go to, like, the gas station across from Floyd College and pull those records. Or in the Wilson case, pull the parking lot footage. I'm sure they had some kind of CCTV somewhere along that stretch. That stretch was very built up, had a lot of retail area. There wasn't really all that much around the Highway 27 shooting, so there's less opportunity there. But especially in the Wilson case, they did nothing they could have easily done to confirm various aspects of the story.
Another one from Chef Johnny F., which says, did Isaac make any calls to police whilst driving?
No, he did have a cell phone, and they pulled that and pulled the records, but there had not been any call since the previous day.
I've got another from Amanda Yost. In the Charm City episode of Season 1, you talked a lot about how gunshot residue is an unreliable test to use if someone has fired a gun. But you seem to place a lot of importance in this episode on the fact that it was not done to determine if Heath Wilson fired from his car. Is it only unreliable on someone's hands?
For me, the significance of that is less what the results would have, I mean, without knowing what they hypothetically did and did not do and what the results show, it's hard to really make a conclusion. But it's more the fact that they had faith in that kind of evidence and they seized the car saying they were going to do it and then nothing. it makes me wonder what was going on in the investigation. If they didn't decide to do GSR testing, why not? And if they did, what happened to it?
We've also got a question from Dave Dawson, who says, where can I get a copy of Lee Patterson's response filing for the Supreme Court case?
Good question. I'll put a link up somewhere on the website.
Oh, okay, got it. Connie, Monica, do you have any questions for Colin and Susan?
I just have to say, it's amazing how active and engaged your audience is with these really specific questions. Like, and I'm sure we've been getting information from people who have been listening to Alberta's podcast. And one of them was just totally unexpected because we've been talking about this truck that she was apparently seen in after she disappeared. And there have been all these descriptions of it, you know, how it had maybe a back seat in the back, or it was a crew cab or an extended cab. And what is, and we basically got an essay the other night from someone who, for some reason, is this expert on Toyota cabs from the 1980s and how they used to make this one that was called an extra cab, and they stopped making it in 1989. And he, you know, basically gave us the dimensions and exactly, you know, how this is probably the truck that Alberta would have been seen in. And so it's incredible that there's this level of engagement, I think, about these stories. As a journalist, I think that it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's always great to have sort of access or greater exposure to the people involved in the case and community involved, which I, you know, people in Rome are hearing this and some have come forward. I wish more had, but also sort of tap into like a larger non-direct community of people who have random knowledge, like about Toyota cabs.
I have a question. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, why it is that Rex Abernathy, this is the lawyer's name, right?
Yeah.
Why doesn't he understand the cell phone evidence? Like, what's the theory behind that? Because I didn't come away from it with the same feeling that I had last season, that there was some reason that the lawyer didn't understand.
I have no idea why he doesn't understand it. There'll be more on that when we get into the appeals and the what happened in the habeas. And Rex Abernathy was deposed in this very issue, which I still can't say why he didn't understand it, but it makes it very clear that he had no idea what was going on.
Okay.
I have a question around production, if that's allowed.
Sure.
How far ahead are you guys in terms of your production of the episodes? Do you know what's happening in the final episode already, or is it kind of like a roadmap?
We have a rough idea of what's going to, a very rough idea of what's going to happen when, especially now as we get closer to the end of the season. But that's about all.
But you guys keep adding shows. You keep saying, oh, yeah. Wait, oh, we need another. Oh, we need another. Don't get me wrong. I love it. I love the show.
We're definitely capped at 24, so we have 3 more episodes to go.
Oh, no. And not enough.
Well, thank you guys so much for being on the show. It was such a pleasure. Connie, thank you for bringing us Missing and Murdered. It's a terrific podcast. It's beautifully produced. And, you know, it seems to be getting some results.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate coming on the show. It's been quite a journey. And I think that just having this kind of podcast format really allows for flexibility that I don't often get in my job. So I'm really appreciative of that, and that people are hearing Alberta's story, because that is really the most important thing.
Yes, Monica, if you're looking for a new podcast in the downtime before, if there's another season of Undisclosed, check out Missing and Murdered. It's beautifully done.
Great. I'm 2 episodes in. So.
See, I'm telling you, but if you can make it through 4, that's the big test, because it will break your heart.
I don't know if I need that, but
yes, at this moment, you might not need that. Do it when you're strong. Okay, listen when you're strong.
Thank you, Monica. Thank you, Connie. And thank you, Colin and Susan, once again, for a great addendum. And that's it for this week's addendum. Once again, I'm going to remind everyone that if you're concerned about criminal justice issues in the state of Georgia, you can donate to the Georgia Innocence Project. For the past 13 years, the GIP has evaluated over 6,400 cases and has successfully exonerated 6 individuals who are serving time for crimes that they did not commit. So please check them out on the web. Give as much as you can. We've had Claire Gilbert and Rick Latta on our show, and they work so hard. Please, please, please help them if you can. You can find them on the web at GeorgiaInnocenceProject.org. And fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #Undisclosed or #JusticeForJoey. If you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use the #UDAddendum, or you can tweet them directly at me at @MrJohnCryer. Also, we've extended the run of the addendum, so if you have organizations for the wrongfully convicted that you'd like for me to consider donating to, let me know. As always, all of the case documents, including those fantastic graphics that show you all about the cell phone evidence, they are available at the undisclosed-podcast.com site, so do check them out. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project, at GA Innocence. I'm going to thank Hannah McCarthy once again and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for our audio production. Patrick Cortez, great music, continuing every day on this show. And Meethal Telhan for managing our project here. Thank you all for listening, and I can't wait to talk to you again after the holiday.